should I make you guys a drink?
Yeah.
Because you were supposed to have a drinking night, so I think we have lots of nice things. We can make nice drinks.
We should.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's now or never.
I can make it for you, and I will be back.
Okay. So, thank you.
So do you want to start recording after? Yes.
I've already started recording.
Oh. Okay.
Sometimes you get the good stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Informing.
He always does that. He like just turns it on without anybody knowing.
Yeah. Let's make it that way.
I remember ages ago he released quite an amazing video about humor and comedy.
But it was like an idiot telling you how to make jokes. But he was right in all the things he said.
Yeah.
But it's just weird when somebody spells it out.
It was basically, he was giving people advice if they were like, if they had no idea how to make any sort of joke at all. Like the most basic guide for like people who have no skills in jokes. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Slightly pink. To think of the universe as a cocktail. Because a cocktail is what it is. It's not good or bad. Or well, it can be good and bad. But a cosmic cocktail is what it is.
Yeah.
And it's got a lot of different elements affecting each other in different ways. And it's just everything and nothing. I don't know why it helps to call it a cosmic cocktail.
You might as well call it a raspberry.
Yeah.
A raspberry cocktail.
But it's just getting silly now.
Cheers, guys. And, you know, I think it's crazy that this is the last night.
Yes. Yeah.
That you're here. How has it been?
It's been awesome. It's been cool to see your lives and how you live in just very normal sense, because it's very easy to go on holidays and just try and do like amazing fun stuff all the time and whatever, but
being like a tourist.
Yeah,
I'm kind of impressed with your ability to not seeming to care at all about doing anything touristy or wanting to see the city or anything.
Yeah, I have no desire to do that.
Really?
It just bores me.
Yeah.
I've done it so many times in so many places.
Mm.
And I just can't be bothered. Because you don't learn anything. You can go and see a cool museum or a cool landmark, but you don't learn anything about the culture and you don't improve your connection to anyone. Or I don't. Or I haven't in the past. And also it's been cool to see how your lives really are, because it's very easy on an online friendship to see I've hardly met you or known you before this, but I've heard about you and seen things online or like heard singing and things like that, and it's very easy to on an online friendship through social media to see just the good stuff. It's so easy, just the like most amazing things, and it can really easily give an impression that like your life is just like singing and yoga. <Yeah.
laughs> And now you're like, nah.
Where's the friggin' music?
Yeah,
exactly.
Everyone's life's like that.
Shall I kick off the episode?
Yes. We need to do. Yeah, this is our first English episode. So
welcome to the Yoruru podcast. This is the first episode in English that we've ever done.
Yes. How do you say Yoruru in English?
Jordero.
Jordero.
Yeah. Jordero. It sounds Jordero. Like a robot.
Jordero.
So we're finally making it into the big international scene. Spiritual podcast. This is our breakthrough.
Yeah.
All thanks to our special guest tonight, which is Zeke.
Yes.
Coming straight from Nottingham or London or whatever.
Somewhere in the UK.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the UK.
Which is still a part of Europe. Or is it?
Yeah, it currently is in the EU. And it will never geographically leave Europe.
No. That's impossible.
Yes. Well, mm-hmm. we will see.
we'll
find a way. Jordero is Swedish, and it sort of means the peace of the earth. And or earth peace. It's that special quality of stillness and peace of mind that you only acquire once you are resonating with your divine essence or chilling out in nature, because that is when you are as you should be. Not that it's good to use shoulds. You shouldn't say should. And yet here we are, uh-huh. using language. Zeke has been living with us for a week, and we've been touching really interesting topics.
We had an interesting discussion with a Qigong teacher today.
Yeah, true.
Ah, yes. Mm-hmm.
About various energetic topics.
Mm-hmm.
Body healing, diet, magical objects.
Yeah.
I want to hear about that.
My Qigong master, Mr. Bjorn,
mm-hmm.
I have been having several private sessions with him, learning about different Taoist techniques for energy circulation, healing yourself, accessing blissful states and things like that.
Mm.
The Chinese have very sophisticated systems for that.
I think most people associate Qigong with like different movements, like
Tai Chi.
Like yeah, a little bit more like the what you see in the park where they do these movements with the hands. I think so it's good that you explain a little bit more what Qigong really is.
Yeah, there is that. There are different movements. I haven't done a lot of those.
Mm.
I've mostly done like Tibao and then sitting exercises.
Mm.
Tibao is like the standard standing posture, where you're just standing in a way and you're trying to optimize all the energy currents in your body.
Mm.
That helps the body heal itself the most, in the most efficient way. And you see, there's lots of... It's not just the blood running through the body.
Mm.
There are also... I don't know, maybe it's just the blood running through the body. But either way, you want that blood to be flowing in a nice way.
Mm. No, but I think you're right. It's not just blood.
It's also... It's
lots of other fluids.
There's like fluid in this, in the spine, isn't it?
Cerebrospinal marrow.
There's
some crazy things going on in there.
Mm-hmm.
Very spiritually significant stuff. And you need to be having a good posture. And I, at the moment, have a slight blockage that I need to work on. Somewhere in the middle of the spine.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Mm.
So there's all of these sorts of things.
To allow the cerebrospinal fluid to...
Yeah,
flow freely.
Yes. I think he's sneezing.
Those cats.
This cat is loving life at the moment.
He has a cold.
My teacher Bjorn is also interested in Kriya Yoga, which I guess comes from India.
Yeah.
Which you like, Zeke?
Which I do like.
Yeah, and you have been practicing that for a year.
Yeah, nearly.
With
pretty much a year.
With very significant results.
With very significant results.
Yeah.
So
was this the first time you tried Qigong? Or did you try?
We did not try Qigong. No, we just had a chat.
You had a chat.
Yeah.
So cool, have you tried Qigong?
No.
No.
But Mr. Bjorn said that it was basically the Chinese version of Kriya Yoga.
Oh.
So okay. Kriya Yoga is principally breath work, it seems to me. Various breathing techniques aimed at slowing down the heart rate, and there's other stretches and lots of chakra work involved, and he said that it's similar, if not identical, in its origins to Kriya Yoga.
Mm-hmm.
Um, and I found a book about learning Kriya Yoga on your own without being involved in a I want to call it a cult, but no, you should call it a sect or a group. I found a book because it's traditionally very secret, and I found a book called Kriya Secrets Revealed by J.C. Stevens.
Now it's out there.
Yeah, and it shows you the techniques of what to
when
do.
When you say Kriya Yoga, is that a specific style that's called Kriya Yoga? I'm thinking that in Kundalini Yoga, they do Kriyas. But
yeah.
Maybe there is something called... I've never heard
it. It's a mysterious word.
Kriya Yoga.
There's a chant that goes, Om Kriya Babaji, and it's not really known why the Kriya Yoga that I've been doing is called Kriya Yoga. Not properly known, but... So yeah, I can't ask your question.
No,
but
okay. Yeah, I think that
word is thrown around a lot in various yoga things.
From what I've heard, it has something to do with purification.
Okay.
And like a Kriya can be a purifying practice. And Kriya Yoga is like an umbrella term for this practice that purifies yourself.
And I, through Casper, I introduced this book to Mr. Bjorn, who I met today. And we had many things to talk about, many things to discuss, because he'd been trying out the techniques. He seems to have many decades of experience in lots of these kinds of practices, and I've only been doing it for a year, and so I had lots of questions of, you know, what's safe, what's not safe, because it's such powerful techniques that I felt like it's necessary to take long breaks and safety checks a lot of the time from the practices I was doing. Because they were so, I could feel that they were very strangely powerful just when I was doing them in my daily 3 times daily routine, and also I'd been reading and hearing stuff about how you could potentially damage yourself in ways that you can't really see.
Like what kind of ways? What's the danger?
Well, I had just read that if you hadn't prepared yourself properly, and because I'm extra concerned about this because I'm doing it on my own without the guidance of a guru or a school, and so I was interested in not damaging myself and finding out the ways to not do this, because I just read that you can, if you do these techniques, these very powerful energetic techniques without the sufficient preparation, then you could mess up certain things in the realm of chakras and not not do yourself any good for the practice. And I want to do the practice correctly so that I get the desired end results of extremes.
You want to get the benefits.
Yeah,
not do it the wrong way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I had some questions for Bjorn about, you know, simple things like is it okay to... Because for me, the main difficulties are practicalities, not doing the practice itself, but the practicalities of daily life. Like sometimes it's just so hard to fit in the same practice at the same time of day. And I wanted to do it at the same time of day every day, for example. And
so what did he say about that?
And he was saying that he wasn't an expert in Kriya Yoga, but in the other energetic practices he's been doing, and he's been seeing other people doing, he didn't think it was particularly dangerous to skip sessions or not do them at the same time of day every day, although it's undesirable because you don't make as fast progress. But he said pretty much all Westerners he's ever known have had to practice in this way, because I don't know why, but I guess it's just because we're a bit less disciplined than the traditions that we're trying to do are used to for the original people they were intended for.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
it's good to be careful, I'm thinking. Especially if you're taking on something like this or anything else just by yourself. I think in general, I would suggest to work with somebody who has already on that path and has been on that path for a long time, so that they can help guide you. And I mean, not only to for the safety of it, but also for the fun of it a little bit that we talked about before.
Yeah.
To make it more fun, because
guru worship is fun.
It's fun. No. Okay, so to straighten out the issue of guru, having a guru, I think having a guru can be nice. But when I talk about having a guru, it's not somebody who's like an idol or somebody who's who you look up to almost like a god or something, as you would in a sect, right?
In a cult.
Or a cult, I would not not recommend that kind of guruship. A guru is just somebody who's been on the path longer than you, but who's also like human, just like you, who makes mistakes, just like you.
And like there's a saying that good teachers are usually good students.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And I heard this this woman, I don't remember her name, but she was speaking on Rack Rosam's podcast, In a Perfect World. And she chose her teacher because he said that I am not a guru, I'm just a student. And that's how she knew that he was genuine and he was not interested in being above somebody else, that or taking on a certain role.
Yeah.
Because you continue learning.
It's nice to work with fellow students.
Yeah.
Rather than someone who's been a complete expert for 50 years and has forgotten the entire process of how it is to learn these things.
They find
it difficult to teach. Mm.
Exactly, it can be very difficult to teach.
But we're touching something important here.
Mm.
It's like you could call it the spiritual dilemma, or even like the existential epistemological dilemma. Like, how do you know a guru is genuine? How do you know a teaching is genuine? How do you know what to pick? Like, you can say that, you think Kriya Yoga seems good, but you're probably thinking that because of whatever you've experienced in your life and whatever you value as good. But those are all notions that you acquire in life through your conditioning.
Yeah.
And you come into this world knowing nothing, and then you randomly get a bunch of knowledge that you absorb from your surroundings. But it's hard to know if that's genuine. And that will create, you will use that as your compass to find a teaching and a teacher. And it's really hard to assess if that's the right teaching. What is the right teaching? Where are we going? What are we doing?
I think, I must say that I don't think there is a right teaching. I don't think there is one right teaching. Not even for you or me as a person. I think there are many things that can benefit us on our journey. And I think we tend to want to put things in boxes. We tend to want to explain things too much to ourselves, and that's why we limit ourselves instead of just opening up and staying open and trying to find our truth. When I did my teacher training in Tantra Yoga, I remember that the best part of it was when the teacher said, "Don't trust me. Go to yourself and experience what is true." And that's how you know what's true. And I mean, most of the time, all the things we know, everything that is things that we've read in a book or that somebody has told us, a teacher, our parents, somebody else, but have we really experienced it ourselves to their level so that we know it's true?
In it. The thing with this Kriya Yoga book is it basically says, okay, the techniques are here. You might as well do them and don't waste any time doing anything else. Don't waste any time talking to anyone else. Don't waste any time walking or commuting to meet with your group, meditation group, because it's all down to you when you're doing it. Yeah.
And that's it.
Sorry.
And in the Gurdjieff work, there's Ouspensky, who's one of the most famous students of Gurdjieff. And he said that basically nothing is possible. No transformation is possible without a group. He's extremely explicit on that point. So it's just really interesting to hear these different perspectives.
Yeah. So yeah, the Kriya book says, don't. don't have a group.
It's sort of the, do you know the Little Britain, the one of those sketches where there's a woman saying, no, computer says no. Kriya book says no. No group, Mike.
No.
Well, yeah, it completely is saying that. So I don't know if I should carry on making this point. But my point was that going into a group, they don't give you all the techniques, and the book says it gives you the book's author, without any solid evidence, makes the claim that he's gone through the original Sanskrit texts of the founder of Kriya Yoga. I can't remember his name. Anyway. He goes through the original text written down by that guy and comes up with a list of the most comprehensive guide, he says, of all the techniques of Kriya Yoga that you need to make significant advancements in the techniques and in the results of the practice. And that he, the author of the book, J.C. Stevens, was involved in a church during his youth that taught Kriya Yoga that didn't teach the right techniques and basically became a kind of cult that just got people spending more and more hours doing the techniques without any results. And so he constantly quotes, that's his name, Lahiri. Lahiri, L-A-H-I-R-I, Lahiri.
Sounds like Timothy Leary.
Indian yoga version of Timothy Leary.
Yeah, awesome.
He constantly quotes him saying things like, don't waste any time doing anything but the techniques. It just the techniques are what will get you there, and don't waste any time going to groups or
drinking Pepsi.
Yeah, and spend the rest of your time serving others. Just do Kriya Yoga. Spend the rest of the time serving others, and that's your life sorted.
And I like it. Today we also talked a bit about Babaji.
Yes,
because
we did.
The author of the book, is from what I haven't understood against praying to any sort of deities or higher gurus or something. And Babaji is not the founder of Kriya Yoga, but he is sort of like an Indian saint, a master of Kriya Yoga. And some people feel like they gain a lot from praising him.
what the book says is that there's a chapter where he talks about prayer, and he says prayer's J.C. Stevens personally says that prayer for him is a particularly useful aid to his Kriya Yoga practice at the end of the concentration part of the routine. Mm. It can last anywhere between 20 and 90 minutes, the routine, probably even more, 90 plus minutes, and it ends with an extreme concentration after lots of chakra work and breathing techniques and stuff. And then you'll do an extremely focused concentration on the third eye.
Mm.
And this, you aim to open healthy flow of prana between all of your chakras, and then focus on the third eye chakra in such an extreme way that it allows a kundalini awakening or samadhi. And then after that, the author says he finds it useful to give a short, quick prayer to Babaji he just says it's useful, basically, because the quality of faith towards something seems to allow you to help yourself and find an inner guidance from a perceived external source, which is the thing you're praying towards. And he likens it to hallucination. I mean, no, not hallucination, hypnotism. He likens it to self-hypnotism as like a way of explaining it to people who aren't used to a religious idea of prayer and faith and devotion to an external thing. Mm.
And this is really interesting, I think, because, Western people with a mainstream paradigm running in their head wouldn't understand any sort of benefits praying to a potentially hypothetical deity or person who's dead since 100 years plus.
Yeah. So,
what are the benefits?
You
gain more concentration.
Basically, I started doing exactly what he said in the book, which was to give a quick prayer to Babaji after doing the concentration practice, which was unusual for me because I was always brought up in a very atheistic environment that rejected prayer and this kind of thing. It was very materialistic scientific in the sort of materialistic paradigm. So it was unusual for me to do this kind of thing, but I liked it and I didn't take it too seriously. I just did it. I just gave kind of thanks to an imagined idea of this figure of Babaji that seems to be at the heart and soul of Kriya Yoga. Mm. And the spiritual benefits behind it of bestowing the gift of consciousness and enlightened consciousness to people through this kind of yoga, through teaching. Because Babaji is meant to have taught this Kriya Yoga to Lahiri and therefore have spread it.
So he was sort of the founder?
Kind of the mystical grandfather founder that no one's ever seen apart from Lahiri.
I think Yogananda is said to have met him once.
Oh, okay. Yeah. He's a kind of a mystical figure that seems to teach various yogic things to people over history, and he seems to be hundreds or thousands of years old. I think hundreds of years old. Some rumors talk about him still being alive in the foothills of the Himalayas and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And personally, I'm so skeptical about all of these things and prayer and everything. But I just did it. I just did the prayer and didn't take it too seriously like I imagine many devout Christians would take prayer very seriously towards their God. I just did it because the book said that an attitude of faith just makes the whole process work so much better. So I did it, and it did. Just by having that attitude, it just gave me encouragement towards it, that there was some sort of help towards me as I was doing the practices. Because the Kriya Yoga practices are very complicated, very complex. And there's lots of stuff involved, lots of stages, lots of different things. And then it's all quite difficult and requires vast amounts of concentration and focus and willpower to do it, to really do it, to properly do it. And it just was nice to have that faith behind me, or not faith, but just sort of a suspicion that there was something. Just by doing the prayer, you can't help but feel like you're doing something, to praying to something. And then when you're then later doing the practice again another day, then I felt like there was something helping me towards doing it many times, as if like, and because it was sort of like a self-confirming thought that or self-affirming thought, like if something was going right during the practice and it was feeling good and great and it was going well, then I would suddenly think, okay, Babaji is helping me, or something like that, like it's working. And then that would help me go further and help me go further and help me go further into the deepness of the extreme experiences I have had from this yoga. So yeah, I'm still quite materialistic myself and skeptical of, like, when I talk about it logically, I don't at all really believe in it. But the attitude of faith and that practice helped me with the techniques.
Isn't there like a lot of both rational and transrational arguments towards faith? Like,
yeah.
You can easily see how believing in yourself and believing in whatever method you're using, whatever tools you're using, has a great overall impact in the attitude and approach you take.
Yeah.
And it just affects your vision and your ability to push through any obstacles. I think that definitely faith is a strength that we don't value enough today.
Yeah.
Because it's something that helps us.
Yeah. Yeah,
in the facing of obstacles.
People rejected it because of, I think it was rejected strongly because of people seeing, like, examples like Christian modern or recent centuries Christian churches that completely disempowered people.
Yeah, and when people question the dogma, it's like, yo, you're just gonna have faith.
Yeah,
they use that as a defense mechanism.
Yeah,
then people notice, oh, it's a defense mechanism. They're trying to hide something from us.
Yeah.
They're trying to preserve their power position.
Which is a thing that has happened a lot. But in terms of a personal, I don't know if I could call it rigorous or sincere spiritual practice, it's very helpful. A sincere spiritual practice towards Samadhi. It's a very helpful attitude, especially for a Westerner who's been brought up in an atheistic background, who has
a stupid background. What's the most unpredictable thing that ever happened to you?
To me? I got born.
Didn't see that coming.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so I think that it is a good time now to release and let go of all our listeners out there. So I just want to thank everybody. Thank you. Thank Kaspar for everything that we've talked about and for this wonderful week also that we've had. I think it's been really great to have here. And hopefully we can come. come back or we can come and visit you. Okay, so thank you everybody and good night. I think we are ready for bed. Yes.
Good night.
Thanks for listening. Thank you.
Du har lyssnat.